We explore the history of the war over history from South Dakota Public Broadcasting. Today is Wednesday, May 5th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, battling over the tone of American history education is nothing new, but it is taking on a distinctly 2021 flavor. The Dakota political junkies talk about Governor Noem, the 1776 pledge to save our schools, and the politics of fireworks over Mount Rushmore. South Dakota's Secretary of Tourism Jim Hagan joins us for a look at the industry during the pandemic. We'll ask how the pandemic will impact how the world views South Dakota for years to come. Dakota Life comes to you from Fort Pierre. We'll have a preview later in the hour. Plus, Richard Tubbles talks tradition and innovation, family and food. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first.
With SDPB News, I'm John Wynn. Governor Kristi Noem is highlighting her push for better internet service throughout the state. SDPB's Chris Loffrey has more.
Some rural parts of South Dakota lack fast internet service. People in the Rowena, Valley Springs, and Garrettson areas have slower internet than residents of nearby Sioux Falls. But that's changing thanks to Governor Kristi Noem's broadband initiative.
So it became one of my number one goals when I became governor to get the entire state of South Dakota connected.
Noem says she was surprised by the lack of infrastructure for residents living so close to Sioux Falls.
You could get just a couple of miles out of pretty populated areas of the state of South Dakota and completely lose high-speed internet access, broadband service.
Noem says the people in these areas struggle with everyday tasks on the internet, but times are changing.
For years, they've needed this kind of service and they just didn't have the ability to access it for their families. And it's really changed their way of life.
Jessica Schopp of rural Brandon says her internet was terrible.
My kids had to go into, during the pandemic, they had to go into town and sit in the parking lots to be able to do their homework. And my daughter Brielle had to redo a chemistry test because it didn't get uploaded.
She says broadband is life-changing for her and her family. Noem says telehealth, working from home, and homeschooling during the pandemic shed light on the need for broadband access.
But this whole pandemic and this last couple of years have taught us that we can live where we enjoy a quality of life and still do our work from our smallest communities if that's where we choose to raise our kids and be successful.
During the last several years, Noem's initiative has spent $30.5 million to install broadband for 16,421 customers across the state. With Jordan Henderson, I'm Chris Loffrey for South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
The only domestic violence shelter in Sioux Falls is getting an upgrade. A groundbreaking ceremony for the new facility took place Tuesday. SDPB's Megan Feary reports.
I'm going to have everybody grab a little bit of dirt on your shovel, please.
Governor Kristi Noem helped kick off the first day of construction on a new building for the Children's Inn.
This ground is not just going to heal people, it's going to heal hearts and souls and stronger families, and exactly what South Dakota is about.
For almost 6 years, the nonprofit has been operating at or above capacity. Amy Carter is the operations director for the Children's Inn. She says the upgrade is needed.
Our current location at Western, we have 40 beds and 24 bedrooms. In the new location, we will have 38 bedrooms and 96 beds. Our bedrooms will be larger, so we'll be able to accommodate families better. I'm excited about that, to give people that space that they deserve while they're healing from their abuse.
Carter says this past year was difficult. Domestic violence cases rose in Sioux Falls. The Children's Inn saw an increase in crisis calls, but a decrease in people seeking shelter services.
Which makes a lot of sense, because that might be their only option, was to contact us via phone versus actually being able to come in for help. But we know that between child abuse and domestic violence, that there's a lot that went on during the pandemic that we might not start to see the effects right away.
The new building will be located on East 8th Street. It is scheduled to be finished in December 2022. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Megan Feary.
For weather today, we're seeing increasing clouds west with a chance of showers later this afternoon. In the east, mostly cloudy with showers likely. Today's highs are in the upper 40s northeast to the mid-60s in the southeast. For SDPB News, I'm John Wynn.
And I'm Lori Walsh. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration has released a report about what is known as climate normals. Laura Edwards is the SDSU Extension State Climatologist, and she's joining us today to help explain why that report matters and what the new normal for South Dakota weather might be. Laura, welcome back to the program. Thanks for being here.
Hi, thank you for having me.
This report covers 1991 to 2020. Tell us about the report itself and how it's compiled.
Yeah, the U.S. climate normals are the snapshot of climate as we see it today. And it's an international standard to use a 30-year period. And these climate normals are recalculated every decade. So it's a lot like the census, where they take all the data every decade and update kind of what is our current climate today. And so we use this a lot, like on the news and weather reports, like how does today compare to normal or compare to average? This is the information that we're using to define what average is for today.
So overall, the U.S. is getting warmer. How much warmer?
Yeah, we are getting warmer overall, and it really varies by region. Actually, in the north central part of the country up here, we're actually slightly cooling now as compared to the previous 30-year period that they had used. But almost everywhere else in the country, they're seeing warming about a degree or so Fahrenheit, where up here we're cooled a little bit by really just a couple tenths of a degree, really just a very little bit.
So your early insights as you look at this massive data about the climate in South Dakota and how it is changing.
Yeah, and it's not exactly, you know, comparable to what we're looking at climate change and long-term climate trends. But again, it gives us kind of our picture of where we sit, kind of what's our current climate on temperature and precipitation. And one of the other things that we see stick out in our region, in South Dakota, is that we are getting wetter. And I don't think that's any big surprise to many of us who have experienced a lot of the flooding in the last decade. And up here, the part of eastern Montana, North Dakota, and South Dakota are all among the areas that are getting wetter faster than most parts of the country.
Yeah. Are things changing more quickly when you talk about that 30 years versus you break down those numbers to 15 years and it appears to a layperson that things are shifting more quickly? What's your insight there?
I think we are when you look at the big picture, comparing, say early 1900s to the early 2000s. If you look at the very long-term trends, we do see some really big changes. And one of the things is temperature, where we've seen, I think, 7 of the warmest years on record just in the last 20 years. So, going back 130 years or so, most of that warmer years are occurring more recently. So we do see those long-term trends on the national scale.
Yeah. How can South Dakotans use the report, for agricultural purposes or business purposes or recreation purposes? What's in it for the average South Dakotan to look at?
Yeah, I think it's really great. Like I mentioned, TV meteorologists, our friends at all our local TV stations will be using this. We'll be using this to communicate kind of what normals are. But yeah, looking at everything from recreation to kind of what to wear today, what is our normal and how we feel about normal kind of climate conditions will all make a difference, I'm sure.
Yeah. Any thoughts before we let you go about the rain that we've been having in certain parts of the state and how it sort of changes the overall drought forecast? Anything new that we need to know right now that you're following?
Yeah, today, we're seeing some rain across, especially the eastern part of the state. Seems relatively light so far, and we really need to keep up with these timely rains, I think, for us to kind of hold steady or, get out of drought, but that northwest part of the state still is struggling. And that's the story, too, of these climate normals. You know, they're looking at 30-year periods, but we're still going to see, you know, a lot of ups and downs in both drought and wet times, despite what the normals or the long-term trends tell us.
Yeah, we see a lot of ups and downs from morning until sunset.
Yes.
Welcome to May. Laura Edwards, thank you so much for being here. We appreciate your time.
All right, thank you.
Ahead on the program, Richard Tubols joins us. We're going to talk about food and family, tradition and innovation. You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
On the next Fresh Air, Alison Bechdel talks about her new graphic memoir, The Secret to Superhuman Strength, about her obsession with exercise and the issues that have fed that obsession. Her graphic memoir, Fun Home, about coming out and learning her father had secret gay affairs, was adapted into a Tony Award-winning musical. Join us.
This afternoon at 2, One Mountain on SDPB.
Program funding by Rise Custom Solutions, wheelchair and mobility specialists, plus expert orthotics, prosthetics, and assistive technology in Sioux Falls and Rapid City, a division of LifeScape. More at risecs.com.
After making it through the worst of the pandemic, hotels and restaurants are ready to reopen, but now a new challenge. Staffing shortages are forcing some to stay closed.
There's nobody to do these jobs, and it's starting to get ultra desperate.
I'm Elsa Chang. A shortage of foreign guest workers and former staff not racing back to work. This afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Listen beginning at 3 Central, 2 Mountain on SDPB.
Program funding by First Interstate Bank. You were made for what you do, and First Interstate Bank was made for that. From business loans to retirement plan services, First Interstate helps get any business ready to do business. More at firstinterstate.com.
Diversity and Minority Affairs reporting on SDPB is supported by Rapid City Rotary Club and the family of Dr. Ashok Kumar.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. There is an Episcopal ministry in the Twin Cities of Minnesota that is not only feeding people who are in need, but also serving a culinary menu based off of the traditional diet that Native Americans have eaten for thousands of years. The Reverend Canon Robert Walter Tubols established his ministry in Minneapolis. It's at the All Saints Indian Mission, and it began in the late 2000s after his ministry in Los Angeles, where he built meaningful bridges between his congregation in Southern California and the people of Pine Ridge. SDPB's Richard Tubols has more on the impact of his uncle's ministry in the Twin Cities. Richard, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Oh, thanks for having me, Lori. You know, I got to sit down with my uncle, and we often have long talks. He's a mentor in my life. So, yeah, he's a second-generation Episcopal priest. My grandfather, who's also, you know, one of my biggest mentors in my life, is a retired priest. And, you know, him and my grandmother have set the standards of kind of how they help the communities that they lived in. And my uncle has kind of continued that tradition with what he's doing in Minneapolis, and specifically like the work he does for the Episcopal Church's Department of Indian Work.
Always tried to volunteer in those kind of ministry programs, you know, places that we lived. You're really serving the people that are on the fringes in society. And I think those are the people that are, when Jesus talks about, you know, the poor, that's who he's talking about, you know, and people who are forgotten or ignored or whatever, because of where the situation in life.
Richard, tell me about his ministry and more about the First Nations kitchen itself.
So, you know, his ministry, it's interesting because, you know, Minneapolis is one of those kind of nuclear zones when it comes to, you know, the recent Black Lives Matter activity and the protests. And anyways, his kitchen is, it's interesting because they have an all-volunteer staff that it doesn't matter what denomination they are, they're coming together and they're striving to stay organic.
Well, you know, first thing about First Nations Kitchen is it's all about making building community, making friends, making relations, because the best way to do that is when you sit down and eat together, a meal. And that's where I think community emerges, you know, good conversations, all that. So that was part of what we do there. You know, pre-COVID, people come and they sit down and we serve them, you know, take their orders, because we usually have a vegan choice, meat with protein, and then, you know, good green salad, all healthy, good stuff. So we get all our stuff from the place that supplies all the organic produce in the cities, co-op food partners. And then during the growing season, we are given produce, or we buy produce from, you know, gardeners. Like there's a group of among farmers, and they'll come on a Sunday, they'll do a farmer's market, and whatever's left, one of the local churches will buy what they have and then turn around and donate it to the kitchen.
So another thing I find interesting about First Nations Kitchen is they stay away from things like chicken, pork, and beef. Richard, why would that be?
Well, like my uncle said earlier, you know, they try to stay organic, Lori. And I think it's really cool because they predominantly use ingredients or proteins that are like pre-colonial, such as tatanka, which is the Lakota word for buffalo. And even like, you know, ingredients from Minnesota, like walleye and wild rice, which is donated from, you know, the local tribes there. So I think what they serve is very ancestral.
So what we don't serve is chicken, pork, or beef. And we try to be careful about what we put into the meals. Like, I try to tell our cooks no salt, no sugar. So, you know, what we're trying to do is, you know, sort of focuses on or harkens back to our ancestral diet, which was, you know, healthy, versus now, you know, like sushi reservation era foods, you know, commodities, and, you know, it's where we've seen an increase in diabetes. And
so, Richard, I've spent a long time in South Dakota, a state that has 9 Native American reservations. I'm often wondered, what exactly are commodities? What are we talking about there?
Well, we often joke about commodities. It's kind of funny. It's a little Native humor. But you know what they are, though, is they represent a modern-day version of the rations that Native Americans used to get when they were put on reservations. So, I mean, I definitely grew up on them. A lot of my family did. And, you know, we used to have things like, everyone jokes about the commodity cheese. But, you know, the bottom line is that, you know, it's not the food that my ancestors grew up eating. And that's kind of the focus of what I believe is what's amazing about First Nations Kitchen, is because not only do they serve healthy food, but they're maintaining like this cultural tradition.
Well, I mean, I think that's, you know, what you know, come, that would come both from the Lakota tradition, you know, or it's, remember growing up, and then, you know, everybody gets fed, everybody eats at these feasts, you know, and everybody can take home food with them, and then the hospitality that one finds in Lakota tradition and Lakota household, you know. And then you add into that this, you know, the teachings of Jesus in the Gospels, you know, where, you know, it's like, you always welcome the stranger. You always, you know, breaking bread, you know, and he's, when he's hanging out or when he's talking, you know, he's breaking bread with people. He's providing hospitality. He's what he's teaching, you know, everybody's fed. And so when you bring both of those together, it's like, you know, it's something, just part of what one does, I think, or one that one should do.
You know, Lori, I always have a philosophy at my house. I'll never turn away a relative or someone who's hungry. I always like to offer them food, or, you know, my grandpa would always say, if it's a simple cup of coffee that you can offer someone, you should do it, because that's, you know, that's what the fellowship that First Nations Kitchens offers. It's very universal. It's kind of the way you want to be treated and the way you want to treat others. And, but it offers something that I think we can all agree, and that's family.
I think it's to know that somebody's getting a good meal and fresh produce to take home. It's going to carry them through the next day or two. To know that, it's some satisfaction. It's like when you cook a really good meal and people enjoy it. You know, people are, you know, just happy, and, you know, it's just like, that's a good feeling. It's like maybe, you know, how, you know, my mom or grandmom would feel after they fed their entire family and everybody's happy and everything. It's probably that kind of feeling.
You know, Richard, you said something about, you know, growing up and hearing those words from your grandfather. And I remember growing up in my house, not to bash on my family, but one of our jokes was, you know, if we ordered a pizza, you never paused to eat the crust. Like, you saved all the crust to the end. Because if you took the time to eat the crust, you would only get one slice of pizza. So being from a family where, you know, on one hand you have commodity cheese, and on the other hand you have somebody saying, give someone a cup of coffee, means you and I come from very different traditions. And mine is scrap to get that last pizza crust. It really makes you kind of think, and this is how you live your life today, even though, you know, you've got kids of your own, and it's been a difficult economic year in South Dakota. This really is something that you carry on in your personal life, that tradition and those stories.
Well, thank you. That was really well said. I was still kind of, I grew up in a family of, I got four older siblings, you know, and when it comes to pizza, it's kind of funny because I'm not a big Supreme pizza lover. So when we go to Pizza Hut, I'd make that, they'd always order that first so that I'd have some pepperoni pizza after. So everyone would chow down on that. But yeah, you know,
pizza just crosses. Is,
the so whole there, idea of diversity is just there, you know?
It's, right. So, but tell me, I want to just get this in before we let you go, and that's the planning on opening another kitchen. So this ministry is also expanding. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, my uncle's done a lot in his ministry, and I think the idea of compassion goes a long way, especially when it comes to people that are underserved, you know. Like I said earlier, Minneapolis has a big Native American population, like Rapid or Sioux Falls, and First Nations Kitchens is like, you know, anyone seeking a meal, and I think that's awesome. Even, you know, it's just not natives either. It's non-natives. And, you know, getting back to your question, yeah, they're going to open another kitchen up in Leech Lake Reservation, and COVID has kind of put them with some setbacks, but that's the current plan, and they're still keeping on, so.
Keeping on, feeding people, even if it's just a cup of coffee at a time, and saying welcome to your relatives. Richard Tubels, thank you so much. It's always a delight to talk to you. We'll see you next time.
Thanks, Larry.
Ahead on the program, we're going to talk politics and the war over history education. It's not new, but it sure is shaping up to look like a 2021 conversation and beyond. You're on listener-supported SDPB Radio.
This evening on Jazz Nightly, we've got new music from guitarist Dan Wilson, who's playing shows the influences of Wes Montgomery, Grant Green, and George Benson. From Canada, we'll hear the Code Quartet, a group inspired by Ornette Coleman. We've also got a live performance from drummer Dave Weckl, along with some classic tracks by alto saxophonist Paul Desmond and pianist Bill Evans. I'm Carl Gerke, and you can join me at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on SDPB Radio.
Program funding by Arts South Dakota, the Annual Arts Education Institute, Band Director Institute, and First Annual Choral Director Institute go online July 12th through the 16th with grad credit available. Register at artssouthdakota.org. Fort Pierre is the host of our next episode of Dakota Life. We'll meet the cowboys of the Diamond A Ranch, meet Pat Duffy, who continues to be a driving force in the community. We'll also look through the lens of photographer John Banaszek, and we'll check in on the expanding bison herd in Rosebud. Greetings from Fort Pierre, our next Dakota Life, Thursday, May 6th at 8, 7 Mountain on SDPB-TV.
Quality news reporting is more important than ever. Your financial support is more important to us than ever. Support radio that's important to you. Become a member of SDPB today. SDPB.org/donate.
I'm Lori Walsh. Today we're going to wade into the politics of American history education. Governor Kristi Noem is promoting what is known as the 1776 Pledge to Save Our Schools. It's an online initiative and petition that calls for a, quote, patriotic education worthy of an exceptional nation, end quote. Is the online petition an email grab for political donations? Is it an acknowledgement of an issue that will define upcoming elections? How does all this intersect with the governor's proposed lawsuit against the Biden administration over Mount Rushmore Independence Day fireworks? And why is Noem being celebrated as the first candidate in America to sign the pledge? Mike Card is Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of South Dakota. Pam Caravu is Professor of Political Science at Black Hill State University. And they're joining us today for Dakota Political Junkies Conversation. Dr. Card, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for inviting me.
Dr. Caravu, welcome as well.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Pam, I want to start with you. Is it a pledge? Is it a platform? What are your initial thoughts on the 1776 Pledge to Save Our Schools?
I think it's a platform, mostly because it, if we look at the political socialization research, just doesn't work. It's really easy for us to connect, say, educational attainment and, you know, outcomes like more voting or civic engagement or political knowledge. So people who have more education tend to do those things more than people that have less education. But political scientists who have dedicated their lives to trying to actually understand this kind of this black box of what happens in the classroom, really struggle with trying to figure out what exactly is happening in the classroom to create those outcomes. And I think that's actually what's most interesting. We can have this conversation about needing patriotic education, but you can design any curriculum you want, and we may still not get the result that you think you're going to get.
Can you help me understand what political socialization is? You said political socialization research.
So that's the study kind of you know, how do we learn things how do we learn things about politics? How do we develop political opinions? How do we develop orientations like partisanship? How do we learn key political values or norms? And those agents, we call them in political science, those people who teach us these things are, number one, our parents and our families, certainly schools, three, peers, and then, of course, media. Those are the primary socialization agents.
All right. Mike Carr, I'm writing this down. Taking notes as we talk. Because I think it's really fascinating because, you know, this helps us understand the conversation about early learning education and state-sponsored preschools. It helps us understand the conversation about lawmakers and higher education and what they feel is happening in higher ed in the state. It helps us really make sense of this, you know, 1619 project that the New York Times did in 2019 and why lawmakers are so why some lawmakers are so furious about that. 1776 pledge, when you saw it, what were some of your thoughts that can expand on what Pam said, Mike?
Well, I think the first thing that caught my eye was, as I read through it, was a couple things, one of which was it is certainly giving what I would say is the received view, the common view of what happened at the founding of our country. And it is certainly appropriate for a fourth grade to start with, here are the things that happened and here's why they happened. They would suggest that we need to get original documents. But the one phrase that sticks out for me is the two-word phrase that is throughout the document, properly understood. And the authors of the document kept referring to, well, you have to properly understand these things. And as Dr. Caribou said, we get most of our properly understood from our parents. We get it from our schools. We get it from our peers. We get it from the media. And what we don't perhaps get from either the 1776 Project or the 1619 Project is that they're both competing stories about where we are now and where we might go in the future.
Hmm. All right. So for listeners who don't understand, the 1619 Project was a ongoing initiative from the New York Times Magazine. And it talked about the 400th anniversary of the beginning of American slavery and reframed the country's history by placing the consequences of that time and the contribution. I'm reading directly from the New York Times, by the way. Consequences of slavery and the contributions of Black Americans at the very center of our national narrative. 1776 Commission started in the Trump administration in 2020. It was one of the last things the administration did. And they released a report that was not footnoted. It was highly criticized. Day one of the Biden administration, they took down that commission report and talked about, you know, bringing truth back into education. So if you don't know what those two, when we say 1619 and 1776, this is this competing narrative. And this isn't new, Pam Caribou. I mean, we talk about Reagan and, you know, the war over history, and this is not the first time in American politics that people have come out swinging over whether we paint a rosy enough picture of America's founding.
You're right. It's not new. And we get these periodic, you know, calls to patriotism. But you know, Dr. Card's point that if we're going to kind of take a look at that, who has the most influence, maybe it really shouldn't be, say, a redesign of K-12 curriculum. Maybe we take a look at what parents are teaching. And again, I would not in any way want to interfere with what parents teach their children, but I think parents actually need to understand how much influence they have over their children's beliefs, I guess. I'm not saying that quite correctly, but gosh, I mean, if we're looking at the one agent that has the most influence, that would be parents.
Right. Political conversations start at home. And Mike Card, those have probably changed a lot. I'm thinking about the fact that I had two sets of grandparents growing up. One were registered Democrats, the other registered Republicans, and I never knew that until I was an adult. So the political conversations we had were not Republican or Democrat. But there was a whole lot of dialogue going around those two tables that now I can point back and I can say, oh, that's why they thought this about this topic. It was part of their, you know, political leanings. Mike Card, when you see students coming into political science classes at University of South Dakota, are they coming in with a strong sense of political party identity? Has that changed over the years?
There is a strong sense of political party identity. There's a stronger sense even than political party identity as to what we should value. Mm. And do we value big government? Although they may not know those terms, they may not want a particular policy because they think it's big government, or they want a smaller government because the value that they've inherited from their parents, that's not actually accurate, that they learned listening at home is whether government is an instrument of good or whether government interferes with individual choice. Mm. And from that distinction, often others are made. That's what I've experienced. Yeah. And to get students to say, well, it can be, but it also might not be. And individualism is a good thing, but there are times when we need collective action. You know, how could we have won World War II without collective action, without a large number of people sacrificing a lot, and some the ultimate measure of sacrifice, so that we could battle threats to freedom? But on the other hand, we also know that there are those who so value individualism that in the small scale, we don't think about government being an instrument of good.
So
do you mind if I...
Yes, please, go ahead.
Mike, I don't know if you notice this too, but a lot of times I have students who come in that have, you know, a strong party identification, but they actually don't know what that means. They don't match their party identification with their actual beliefs. And so, you know, we take a little bit of time to talk about, okay, well, this is the Republican Party platform. This is the Democratic Party platform. These are the programs that this group would support versus these. So they know things like, maybe they think they're a Republican or they think that big government is bad, but they also hold beliefs. Social security is good. Public education is good. So there's actually an interesting, disconnect between what they think they are and what they believe and other ideas that they hold, you know, dear as well. So I think that's really interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. If I were to follow on to that, it's almost as if their identity as a political party membership without exactly knowing what or why the party believes what it does.
Mm.
And you mentioned your upbringing. Well, I am the son of an Oklahoma Southern Democrat and a South Dakota born banker. And we too did not have political party conversations, but at that time it was a fight within the Republican Party, the progressive wing versus the stalwart wing. Back in the 60s and 70s when I was a teenager and more formative years. Mm. But again, we have an affiliation with the party. You know, the Republican Party has won over 3 of every 4 elections in South Dakota. And most recently, there seems to be a lack of the progressive wing of the Republican Party, both at the state level as well as at the national level. And as Senator Thune says, where are the ideas? We should be on ideas and not personalities.
Yeah. Mm. All right. Well, we're going to have to push our fireworks, how this all intersects with fireworks and Confederate statues, to another day. But I'm fascinated by this idea of political socialization. And here we are having this in-depth conversation on the show. And I hope that other people will have these kinds of conversation amongst their peer groups. And it's all part of, you know, the family you came from, the school you went to, what radio show you tuned in today, and how you talk about it with your friends. And hopefully we've added to the thoughtfulness of that dialogue, if nothing else. Dr. Pam Caravu from Black Hills State University, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Dr. Mike Card from the University of South Dakota, Professor of Political Science, thank you as well.
It was wonderful to be with each of you today.
Well, as a new batch of South Dakota seniors in high school eagerly anticipate graduation for 2021, some took time to reflect and share with South Dakota Public Broadcasting about how the COVID-19 pandemic impacted their final year of high school. Today, we hear from a Sioux Falls Roosevelt High School senior.
I'm Carly Hetland, and I'm a senior at Roosevelt High School. COVID put a lot of differences into my senior year and even last year. A lot of things were taken away, and if they weren't taken away, then they were adjusted and different than how they would usually be. And it just made you realize that you need to take every day like we're going to get school called off again. And now this year I'm like, okay, I need to enjoy this last basketball game I'm cheering at just in case we don't get one again. Or, I don't know, it just makes you think, like, to be grateful for what we have in the moment. So I'm in show choir. I'm in sideline cheer. I cheered for varsity basketball for my junior and senior year. I was a part of student council. I'm the president of our Cancer Awareness Club. You know, in middle school, they always tell us to get involved, get involved, get involved. And seriously, I'm glad I did because I created so many friendships. This year, I feel like we connected even more because we were all going and struggling through the same thing. And all of our feelings were valid and the same. So it definitely helped because you knew that you weren't alone and we all had each other anyways. Okay, we got to have one in-person competition, and it was different because we had to wear masks, obviously, and singing and dancing with masks on can be very difficult. Usually, we would travel all over the Midwest for competitions. Instead, we just recorded a video. Well, it's just different, like, because you only get your senior year once, and you only get your high school experience once, so when things are taken away or even different or you get half of what you're used to, it just isn't the best feeling. No one else understands and gets me or my friends like we do for each other. So we all are going through the same thing. So it's easy to be there for one another and lift each other up when we can.
That is Sioux Falls Roosevelt High School senior Carly Hetland in her own words. Up next, Jim Hagen with the South Dakota Department of Tourism is with us. You're on listener-supported SDPB.
I'm Tanya Mosley. David Oyelowo has received acclaim for his acting in films like Selma. Now he makes his directing debut with the mystical family drama, The Waterman.
There are stories I want to see in the world. I can either complain about them not existing or I could do something to make them exist.
That's next time on Here and Now.
This afternoon, beginning at 1 Central, Noon Mountain on SDPB Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Alison Bechdel talks about her new graphic memoir, The Secret to Superhuman Strength, about her obsession with exercise and the issues that have fed that obsession. Her graphic memoir, Fun Home, about coming out and learning her father had secret gay affairs, was adapted into a Tony Award-winning musical. Join us.
This afternoon at 2, One Mountain, on SDPB. Imagine a South Dakotan who cares about current events and education, who contributes their time and money to help make their community a better place to live. You've just imagined a listener of SDPB. If your company needs to reach well-educated, loyal customers, please consider becoming an underwriter. SDPB is a trusted source, and your company message doesn't have to be loud or long to get attention here. Our listeners will notice you. Email us, underwrite@sdpb.org, to get started.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh, and this is National Travel and Tourism Week. South Dakota was third highest in the nation for domestic visitation last year. We're joined now by South Dakota's Secretary for Tourism, Jim Hagen. Welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Hey, Lori. Thanks for having me on, and happy National Travel and Tourism Week.
I have my state park sticker, and I'm ready to hit the road.
All right. Perfect.
So overall, the visitor industry suffered pretty sharply at the beginning of the pandemic, but by the end of 2020, we'd seen 12 million visitors. What can you tell us about the numbers and what they say about the state of the industry?
Yeah. So, 2020 was an incredibly challenging year, as we all know. I think back to a year ago at this time and just, wondering, Lori, what was going to happen? What would happen to the tourism season? How would our small businesses do? Would they even survive our hotels and motels? As people started finding their footing, things started looking better. And there definitely, Lori, was a segment of the American population, as we were doing our marketing and doing our research, that said, I'm traveling. I'm going to travel regardless of everything we're going through. And so, we really felt a responsibility to get a marketing message out there that assured them that we were open, but we would be safe. And so they came. And we did welcome 12.6 million visitors in 2020. Now, our record-setting year of 2019 was 41 million visitors. So not a lot less visitors. They spent $3.4 billion in a record year. You know, we saw them spending $4.1 billion. So 2020 really turned out so much better than what we had thought. And now it wasn't equal across the state. The eastern half of the state definitely suffered much more than the western half of the state. The eastern half of the state is much more reliant upon conventions and meetings and you think of Sioux Falls and sports tournaments, things like that. But, you know, we have to declare the country national, and 88% of the American Gloria says that they are going to travel this summer over the next 3 months. And in fact, we've got new day a few days ago, and South Dakota is actually leading the nation. So we're the performing state, entire country when it comes to travel and tourism. Perfect in terms of recovery, but we're getting there.
Yeah. So also people want to know, because of an analysis from the New York Times, it says South Dakota had has the third highest COVID infection rate per capita, the ninth highest death rate. People want to know, did millions of out-of-state visitors impact our ability to fight the pandemic here at home?
Right. You know, you hear voices on both sides, those saying, you know, hey, there were cases created as a result of visitors. You see studies that say otherwise. What we're really doing, Lori, is we have a responsibility as a department to do two things. One, if we're open, we need to encourage the industry to have those protocols in place. We encouraged them in 2020 to do so, to make sure that they were keeping our visitors safe, and we're encouraging it today. What consumers are telling us, almost 60% of travelers say that they still want to see health and hygiene protocols in place. So every time I'm speaking to the industry, whether it be in person or via email message, I keep reminding them to keep those protocols in place. Do not roll them back at this point in time, because the traveling public still wants to see them. And so our job is just to stay focused on that and keep looking ahead and listening to what consumers are saying and doing all we can to give them a safe experience while they're here.
Yeah. So your department strives to avoid politics, and you and I have talked about this before, and you say, hey, we don't check your, you know, voter registration card at the border. Everyone is welcome. But we also have to look at 2021, and the biggest event last year was a controversial presidential visit during an election year, during a pandemic, that included nationally televised protests as well as fireworks. And our governor says things like, call me when you're an American. So I'm curious to know what your role is as Secretary of Tourism, as an advisor to the governor, about how politics intersect or impact the state tourism industry and therefore the economy.
Right. I mean, we, you know, our job really, as you said, our job is to stay focused on the American traveling public. We don't look at political affiliations, anything like that. Our marketing message is to just tell people about all the wonderful things there are to see and do in this state. And I really believe, Lori, that travel is a wonderful way for people to learn about other cultures, to appreciate differences between human beings, difference, whether that's a political difference, a religious difference, all of those things. What we want visitors to do, and our industry is so great about doing this, and our citizens are great about doing this, is when those visitors come, they treat them you know, royally. They really do. I hear it every week from people saying, we just felt it at home. We may have differences of opinion, things like that, but I can tell you when we got to your state, nobody treated us any differently. And so that's what we're really focused on.
Do you have conversations with Governor Noem about politics and the impact on the state tourism economy?
You know, we don't per se have those conversations, Lori. And of course, we visit about different things. And the governor has, I know she has her hand or her finger on the heartbeat of what's going on. She understands. And what we, you know, what we do again is just to really stay focused on here's what we have to offer you. Again, we're not going to question your beliefs, anything else when you come into this state. Just come and have a great time. And that's what we stay focused on. That's what we do. And we're going to continue to stay focused on that. You know, one thing I've also found through the years, Lori, as I've traveled not only domestically, but internationally as well, you know, we all go to different states. We go to different cities where there may be statutes in place, rules, regulations, laws that we don't necessarily agree with. And they may not align with our beliefs, but you know what? We're there to enjoy a vacation, have a good time. We put those aside. I put those aside. And as I tell visitors all the time, you can travel to any state and you'll find a law or an opinion that is different from yours. That'll never change. It's always going to be the case. But we're here, like I said, just to show you our great faces and great places. And we hope that they enjoy their time.
You mentioned you've been talking this week about those H-2B visas, and President Biden has increased the allotment of seasonal worker visas to add 22,000 more in the coming months on top of the Trump administration's 66,000 nationwide. How are those allocated from a state-by-state basis? What is the process for that? When will we know more?
Yeah, great question, Lori. So the 67,000 workers that are normally allocated, another 22,000 were announced. Now, they're just thrown into pool, free, and it's granted the lottery. So you have to apply. My understanding is that the percentage isn't allocated to any state. Businesses across the country just put their applications in, and it's really a lottery. You may win or you may not. And so, you know, that's a lot of workers for needs that are across the entire country. And it's not just the tour industry. I mean, those H-2Bers are working in industry, the construction industry, and just all sorts of different areas. And so, you know, what we did, Governor did announce, focused on not just this year, but in the year ahead too, is doing a better job with the Department of working with the Department of Labor to put a spotlight on positions when it comes to tourism and hospitality jobs. Encourage people to go to SD Works, Labor's SD Works website, and pair them with jobs in travel and tourism. So we're just getting started. We have a new meeting on today to add some more detailed program. We'll be issuing some more information program from the day. So just stay tuned for that. But yeah, there's no question. Labor's a huge issue for us, not only in the state, nationwide, in other with travel and tourism jobs. So we're just going to try to find some innovative things to do that maybe will encourage some folks to come spend a couple months with us. And I'm especially focused on retirees. Maybe there are retirees in other states, retired teachers, things like that. They'd be willing to come for 3 months or six sure. months, and they have the ability maybe to stay in an RV or place. You know, you add on the top of that the challenge of housing, too. So there's a lot. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm gonna jump in here because we're losing our connection a little bit, and we're gonna shift into telling some stories of just a few of those places that you might want to visit in South Dakota when you travel. But thank you so much to Secretary Jim Hagan with the State Department of Tourism.
Thank you, Lori. And
Larry Rohr is with us from South Dakota Public Broadcasting. Hey, Larry, maybe you want to go to Fort Pierre to check out some of the things there as you hit the road and do a little in-state travel for our listeners. How are you, Larry?
I'm good, Lori. And I do. We have family in Pierre. And so visiting Fort Pierre, our host community for our final show of the season for Dakota Life for this year, it'll debut tomorrow, was a familiar visit, but me personally, I've learned a lot about the communities we visited, a lot more than I was aware of before we got there, as we tell their story amidst the other stories that we tell on the program.
All right. So tell us a little bit about what's ahead. It premieres this Thursday evening at 8 Central, 7 Mountain on SDPB TV1 with, again, that host community of Fort Pierre. Are we going to hear from, Larry?
Overall, in the program, we've got some stories lined up, and we've got a couple about Fort Pierre and the Fort Pierre area that will be included. And one is about there are a lot of amazing personalities from history and currently in Fort Pierre. And one of those that kind of bridges both is Pat Duffy. Pat and her husband owned the Chateau. It was one of the famous cowboy bars. But at 90, She is so active in the community with Meals on Wheels, with an after-school program for the youth, helping to put together a community center and a youth center. She's at work every day at 6 o'clock in the morning and says, I'm going to keep coming as long as I can. And we've got a story about the cowboy past as well. There was one of the largest ranches in the country was part of a multi-state operation called the Diamond A, and they were active from Fort Pierre up to the Eagle Butte area in the early 20th century, and we've pulled together some of the former employees, some of those old-time cowboys who worked with some of the originals, and we'll tell that little story as well. And we're going to travel down to Rosebud. They've got a great plan for rebuilding the buffalo herd in Rosebud, and you're going to get a chance to see not only how they're doing that, but the partnership that they've put together with the National Park Service. And then we're going to visit one of the winners of the Governor's Awards in the Arts, and we're going to look through the lens of photographer John Banajic, who is also a professor at University of South Dakota mm-hmm. and teaches photography. So we're going to visit with John. He doesn't wear his famous English racing hat that I always see him with in Vermilion in the program, but it's very interesting and giving man, and how he talks a little bit about his own accomplishments and how he challenges students in the program as well.
Yeah. So the Diamond A Ranch conversation, Brian Gevick brought mm-hmm. us some audio from that earlier in the week. And Larry, I don't think I've had such a good time on the radio than listening to those ranch hands tell the stories of what it was like to work in the time of you know, few fences and open ranges and some pretty tough cowboy coffee as well.
You know, and what I've learned a lot, because I've been around Pierre and Fort Pierre, but talking, we had some audio that we'll bring a different time of mm-hmm. Mayor Gloria Hansen, from who is in her fourth term of mayor of Fort Pierre. But there's a lot of history, and they're very, very proud of it. Fort Pierre has celebrated a bicentennial. It was actually mm-hmm. established in 1817. No other city in the state has. And they're proud of the cowboy history, the Casey Tibbs. They've got the depot has been remodeled. It's a historic area. And there's a lot of kind of West River moxie history as well. But mm-hmm. but things are changing in a unique way in Fort Pierre. There's a lot of new industrial development. They've got three different residential developments where they've built canal off of the Missouri River into neighborhoods. So you have river access in your backyard. Now, it's not mm-hmm. an original idea, but they're really utilizing that feature. And there's a new marina that's under construction that will do something similar. And and they're building a new bridge because
right.
Fort Pierre is a bedroom community pier. They celebrate that. And there is also a new Fort Pierre to Pierre bridge coming that's under construction and will be in place and ready to drive over in 2023.
So even if you've been to some of these places in South Dakota, go again, because they are changing all the time. It's the season finale of Dakota Life. It premieres tomorrow night at 8 Central, 7 Mountain on SDPB-TV1. And you can see that and more stories at sdpb.org/Dakota Life. Larry Rohr, thank you so much for being at this. We appreciate it.
Always a pleasure, Laurie.